It's the Trupany Show with your host, James Trupany.
Hello and welcome to the Trupany Show. My name is James Trupany. This is my show. You may notice I'm a little bit quieter than normal and not quite as enthusiastic. I have a sore throat and a cold, which is the reason why last week's Trupany Show was a little bit late. Apologies for that. But we're back on track now. And today we're talking about Bound for Glory, Impact Wrestling's biggest show of the year. And to join me to talk about this momentous occasion is Mr. Marcus Green of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and WrestleTalk.tv. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. Glad to join you, even, with the cold. Hopefully, like I said, you can power through it. But, usually I'm the one that's trying to pick out the brighter side of these things. But I don't know if it's going to be that way today.
We will see. We will also be talking about Power Struggle later on in the podcast from New Japan Pro Wrestling, which is something that's a lot more bright and impactful, shall we say. Yeah, now, normally, Ben Spindler of The Squash accuses me and you of being the sunny side, lighter people who are sickeningly positive about everything. That ain't going to happen today, is it?
Nah, just... Not today. It's just some things you can't ignore. And as much content as we inhale throughout the week, yeah, we just gotta, you know, put it to the fire this week. Sorry. But,
yeah. Okay then. Bound for Glory opened with a promo from Alberto Del Rio, which I missed because I fast forwarded it because I saw, oh, it's going to be a promo by Alberto Del Rio. Sorry, Alberto El Patron. Get his name right. It's going to be a promo by Alberto El Patron. I don't need to see this. I fast forwarded it through it, and then I read the transcript afterwards. And, dear God, who thought that was a good idea? Really? Alberto El Patron talking about his suspension for possible things. Well, let's go with the safe thing and say innocent until proven guilty. But why draw attention to the fact that your major face has been under suspicion for something not very nice? And then draw attention to it on your biggest pay-per-view of the year. Who in their right mind thought that was a good idea?
I don't know what was the thought process going into that. It was just, I mean, because when I watched the show, it got put in the middle of the show.
Right.
So, I mean, it died a death. I mean, really. I mean, he was just going on and on, and the crowd wasn't feeling it. It really just killed the vibe of the show, which really wasn't, you know, enthralling to, you know, up until that point anyway. But, I mean, it really was just poor, and I didn't care because, you know, we kind of know some of the stuff that's actually went on, so... him trying to get some sympathy, and I think he mentioned his kids, which he never does by name specifically. But it killed the crowd, it killed the fans watching at home, and it tried to pick up some momentum with him going out to Bull Rash. But by then, it was just like, please get off my screen.
Yeah, it was just atrocious. Just why bother? Why hire him in the first place? We had the suspicion it was going to be a train wreck. He's been phoning it in for 18 months. So why bother? Why go to the expense? But there you go. Anyway, let's get to the actual proper wrestling. The first match was Trevor Lee defending his X Division Championship against Desmond Xavier, Garza Jr., Matt Sydal, Petey Williams, and Sonjay Dutt. In 12 minutes and 25 seconds, Trevor Lee successfully defends his title. Now, the match itself wasn't bad for what one of these things was, but I'd really much rather seen a one-on-one match between Trevor Lee and Petey Williams or Trevor Lee and Sonjay Dutt. It was nice to see Garza Jr. and Matt Sydal swapping back down to the X Division because it gave the X Division match some gravitas. Those guys have been hanging in the main event of the heavyweight division, so I like that. But it did what it did. It was 12 minutes and 25 seconds. Get your stuff in. Nothing really to sink your teeth into or to make me care more about any of these guys. What did you think, Marcus?
I'm gonna echo your sentiments. I really was let down by this match. Normally, you know, they always kick off one, you know, these big shows with the X Division stuff, and usually it's kind of what we've seen in New Japan a lot of times with these multi-man tag matches.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of high-flying stuff and whatnot, and a lot of people, like you said, always get their stuff in. But this was just, I guess they tried to slow it down with putting in that tag stuff in there, but if you go outside, you're legal. So by the end of it, everybody was just kind of scrambling. But for me, just like you, I want to get back to singles competition, like what they did early in the year with the great feud between, who that was, Low-Key and Sanjay.
Yeah.
And one thing they did that they absolutely have dropped the ball on was that whole Super X Cup thing, having Desmond Xavier win it, a great talent, but he wins it, and then he seemingly gets basically shelved into the background until a couple of weeks they put him in like a mixed tag, and then last week they let him get a win on Impact. But he's really kind of just been put in the background. And if you're going to build something like the X Cup up to be important, you would want to build up the winner to be equally as important. So I thought they could have been served better building this guy up to face Trevor Lee, since apparently he has some great mind control to make all his enemies come to some type of cult with him. So I thought they would have been better served building to a singles match, and if you know, at least build Xavier up to feel important, because you had him win this tournament, which really didn't send me over the moon. But you know, you got this young, great emerging talent, and I would just feel like you kind of just hodgepodge this shot in with a bunch of other guys.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's like if you take a page out of the New Japan book, Kushida wins the Best of Super Junior tournament. We know how important the Best of Super Juniors tournament is. It's got a long and storied history. We know what happens. They get a title shot, and he did get a title shot. He turns that title shot into a title win, and it's a long arcing story. And Xavier has no story now. What's he going to do? What's next? He can chase the championship, but he's already been beaten. You know, it just falls flat. There's nothing there to sink your teeth into to this, what's the next stage. Well, I guess the next stage is Petey Williams versus Trevor Lee again, which is fine. But, you know, it just seems like a match that's just getting you somewhere. There is no resolution. It's a TV match just plumped in the middle of, well, the beginning of a pay-per-view.
Exactly.
Okay, the next match was Taiji Ishimori versus Tyson Dukes, 4 minutes and 50 seconds. Sorry, Tyson Dukes. I apologize. Got his pronunciation wrong there. Tyson Dukes, very good wrestler. Taiji Ishimori, very good wrestler. Exceptional match, 4 minutes and 50 seconds. The best thing on the card that had no build-up whatsoever, and we didn't even know it was on the show till the actual show started.
it was a great little match. Two really good talents. But like you said, it kind of just felt like something that they had to throw on there last minute, because obviously one of their biggest draws on the show didn't happen. So, you know, this felt like another instance on the show where they kind of had to kill some time and, you know, needed a slot. So they kind of threw them two out there. But like you said, it was probably one of the better things of the night, despite not having any build whatsoever. So
possibly because no one had actually ruined it with a story. And through most of that match, Laurel Van Ness wandered around drunk and looking for a man. Abyss versus Grado in a Monsters Ball match, which is 20 minutes and 40 seconds of a wrestling match that's 20 minutes too long. This was dreadful. There is no other way. It's just bad. I love Grado. I love Abyss. I even love Laurel Van Ness. And their work has been exemplary, but none of this is entertaining because none of the subject matter is entertaining. Mental health issues are not funny. Alcoholism, as apparently Laurel Van Ness has returned to the bottle, is not funny. Immigration issues are not funny. None of this was funny. It was a really bad idea executed as good as it could be by three people who knew what they were doing. And I'm glad it's over. Sorry, end of rant. What did you think of this, Marcus?
I was kind of looking forward to this match just to see if, you know, Grado would kind of, you know, turn up that serious vibe. I thought they did some solid stuff in one of those last promos leading up to the show where, you know, they had the whole thing about him signing the contract and basically calling out Joseph Park, and Grado was real serious, and he felt real, you know, had some gravitas to him with that. But this match just, I mean, I guess this was supposed to be the Yano Suzuki match for Power Struggle, but obviously one side did it right. this was just a hodgepodge of stuff. You had Laurel at ringside. They kept cutting to her. I mean, it's not like the match was great, but then they kept cutting to her randomly. So that sucked. I mean, they finally had an avenue to get her out of that character, and they put her right back in it. So that sucked. I think she could be served better in the ring actually wrestling, but she isn't exactly Gail Kim. I get that, but, you know, you kind of need more talent. So, But with this match, I mean, it was just a hodgepodge of stuff. And then they threw Rosemary in there, which obviously she needed something to do at the end. It was cool seeing a little of that history play out between her and Abyss towards the end, but then they kind of had her turn heel.
It was just a mess, because it's like she comes down, saves Grado from Laurel, then she tries to help Abyss but screws that up, hurts Abyss, but Abyss wins anyway. So Rosemary flipped heel, then flips came in and acted as a face, then acted as a heel, but really she's a face.
Yeah. And then we have like a ring bell botch in this.
Yeah, yeah, there was a ring bell botch as well because Grado got a very close to two count, but the ring bell went the timekeeper get going. So we kind of let that telegraph the ending. So it may have had a different ending to that. I'm not sure what works if you have him win or lose, to be honest. And I'm not convinced we'll see him leaving either.
Yeah, they'll find some kind of way. But yeah, I mean that ending was crazy. I appreciate the unprettier from Laurel, but that whole ending was just a high spot. And then like the softest black hole slam I've seen. One of the softest black hole slams I've seen. How I missed the real Monsters Ball days of between Bram and Abyss. It was literal trying to catch up.
Yeah, Bram, who has been released today, or Astra is released today. So there's another one gone. This was just dreadful. It was just really bad. And it's like all three of them, they could have done so much more with all three of them. And it was just like the setup was bad. This storyline was terrible. The characters they have to play, they're doing very well with what they've got, but it's just not good. And then this match is just, like you said, there's just a bunch of stuff happens and there's no real story to it. You know, I mean, and also they took some serious bumps in this match as well. Grado coming off the top rope through a barbed wire board, that was a pretty serious bump for this level of match, and he's clearly trying very hard. But it didn't. Big bumps don't make a match. You have to have a story there, and this was just too much of a mess.
Yeah. I always appreciate the effort from these guys, but by the end of it, it is a train wreck. And, you know, like you said, you can't really be too invested in the stakes because you figure like they're going to kind of finagle some kind of way to get Grado back as they have in the past.
Yeah. So, and we've had three matches and two of them have been gimmick matches. And then we get to a six-man tag. So, yeah. Anyway, the six-man tag, which was all right, really. 15 minutes and 30 seconds, but it started slow. It was stodgy. It got going a bit towards the end and I kind of got into it more towards the end. But six main event guys not really putting as much effort in as their main event status would put together, really. It was like, how can you have so much talent and not enough stuff happening with this match? Maybe I'd got turned off into this show too early and I was being far too cynical. I don't know. But this match had some nice moments in it. I did like the ending with them all sharing a beer together, you know, team impact, and they finally all trusted each other. But to me, it was all just a bit, everything got kind of jigsawed together to make this match work, and I'm not sure it did. Though the story has been one of those age-old stories of wrestling, which is usually the kind of thing I like. Basic, simple psychology. Can Eddie Edwards and James Storm trust Ethan Carter III? Well, actually, yes, in the end, they can, and they were kind of playing off on it to get the team AAA to fall apart as they went through this match. What did you think of this, Marcus?
Yeah, I thought it was solid overall. Like you said, it did start slow in the beginning and kind of had some, you know, little friction there with EC3 kind of being, I guess, reluctant to get into the match, kind of, you know, being in his own way, if you will. But towards the end, it did pick up. Elvis took a nasty Thriller to Kill from our former King Cuerno in Phantasma. Yeah. How I miss Lucha right now, but like I said, it was good for, you know, this whole thing with EC3 and Storm has been one of the more interesting things. Hopefully they, because I wanted them to kind of get to a point where they're like, look, we'll put it aside to win for the home team, but we still got to finish our business, because EC3 still is the champion of a title that needs some feuding power behind it, and you know, he's you know, Storm is a guy he could do that with. So, you know, maybe they'll figure out some kind of way to get back there. I don't know. But for this match, I really wasn't into the whole stakes of it all with the bragging rights. But, you know, the match quality itself was one of the more solid things to show. And like you said, the ending with them celebrating together was fun and stuff. And Edwards didn't break his neck. So that was good.
Which is good. Yes. Yeah. But one thing that strikes me, when Texano went into Lucha Underground, he seemed like such a superstar. You know?
Yeah.
And he comes into this match, and Pagano to a lesser extent, and Phantasma, and they just like three other guys, you know. And it's just like they're big main event names for AAA. So treat them like big main event names. That's just me, really.
Yeah, I mean, and it kind of felt like I don't know how you felt about it, but did it feel like kind of Pagano felt like he was out of place at
yeah,
times? Like,
he's. I think also he's got a very, like, Phantasma and Texano have adapted their Lucha Libre style to a westernized style, to a US style, I should say. Whereas yeah. Pagano hasn't. He's still very much a lucha wrestler. And I think that's what perhaps puts him a step back.
Yeah, because it felt like in the match he did some moves and he was kind of waiting on something to happen and never did, so he kind of had to improvise.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you get that a lot sometimes, especially with guys that haven't wrestled each other very much. I remember back in the days of WCW, Jushin Liger was doing stuff no one on the WCW roster knew how to do. So they kind of, like, they didn't have to bump for it. And there's a couple of spots where I think it's been on Botchamania where, like, Liger's thrown somebody into the ropes to do something and the other guy did completely the wrong thing. So, yeah, it's and you just give up and tagged out in the tag match. But, yeah, so sometimes it just doesn't plan out if he hasn't, if no one knows exactly what's coming and he hasn't had time to explain what he wants, then sometimes it just doesn't work. Okay, we move on to match five, which was a 51-50 street fight for the Impact World Tag Team Championships. With the champions, Ohio versus Everything, Dave Christ and Jake Christ taking on Latin American Exchange, Ortiz and Santana, with Conan in this particular match. 10 minutes and 35 seconds of a match that was okay for what it was, and it was a street fight, and he got in everything that we expected. I'll explain about the ending in a minute, because that was a bit odd. I still have no idea what Ohio versus Everything is about. After being watching them for 3 months, I'm no closer to understanding them now than I ever have been. And Latin American Exchange are good for what they are. They're just too generically good. I haven't yet seen anything truly special from either of them. But this match was solid for what it was, and I'm not going to complain about that again, because they put a ton of effort in. But I'm not quite sure what's going on here. Explain it to me, Marcus.
Yeah, I mean... LAX is just, you know, LAX, Ohio versus Everything. While, like you said, there's not a lot of, you know, depth in terms of what's into these two guys. I like them because they're kind of obscure, and they kind of work in a weird way for me. But, yeah, I mean, I guess you really got those two clashings of, you know, how these two teams are, which, you know, I appreciate it. And obviously somebody like Conan, who, you know, is great, is a great talker, has helped that a lot. But with this match, I thought it was solid, like you said, for what it was, but it suffered. I think it could have went longer. Obviously, the perro sucked up all the time. Yeah, I mean, like you said, I appreciate it for what it was, but it definitely could have been long, considering the fact that they've actually been building this particular feud more than we've seen for some of the other matches on the show. So, yeah, I definitely get you with the having kind of investment. We've not really seen too much in terms of depth when it comes to Ohio versus Everything. They're two solid workers. LAX has been more entertaining for me just because of those clubhouse vignettes. Hmm. But, yeah, they could and I'm trying to see. I think, did they turn them face in this match by the end of it?
See, that's the thing. You see, then Sammy Callahan comes out and cuts a promo as he's a member of Ohio versus Everything and kills the crowd stone dead. The crowd were really up at the end of the match and everything went flat. And he had no reaction whatsoever. And Sammy Callahan's a big name on the independents, obviously a former WWE wrestler. You kind of figure this is going to work, but nope. And of course, also, yeah, Latin American Exchange were laying out on the floor and Ohio versus Everything were beating them up. They're the faces. They beat the hell out of the LAX. Have they flipped them? Is it a double turn, or was it just badly executed end to the match?
Yeah, it's weird because it just came so out of nowhere. Because you know, LAX feel like they're natural heels in Ohio versus Everything, obviously. But I guess they thought Callahan was gonna have more behind him.
Yeah.
In terms of crowd recognition when he came out, and obviously he didn't get that. Another name who has done well to be in Lucha Underground, has picked up a lot of momentum from being in Lucha Underground, but it just didn't necessarily carry over. Because you take his character out of, you know, Lucha Underground, and I put him against somebody like Drake. But yeah. These aren't those characters. Lucha Underground is very, very much in its own world. So him, like another character that came out later in the show, at the announcer's table, I guess, didn't really get the reaction they were looking for.
No, Jimmy Jacobs also made his presence felt, which is understandable why he probably didn't get any pop whatsoever, because he wasn't as big a name in independent wrestling as some of the guys that end up on Impact Wrestling. And, you know, his work in WWE was all behind the scenes. But from what he said, it implies that he is working for Impact Wrestling going forward, which will make Chelsea very happy because she loves his booking and his storyline development. So maybe it will round some edges off of these convoluted, change the direction of this company every 3 months issues that they have, if they can get someone with some power who can do some long-term narrative writing. But I'm not really sure. We'll see.
Yeah, same here. I mean, it's only so much confidence I can have. I think maybe guys like Bull Rash and Abyss or some other people are behind the scenes. I maybe think Pritchard is back, I heard. But I also think Big John is back, which I am not a fan of because he's literally driven people away from the company.
So. Yeah, this is the thing. A lot of business decisions have happened in Impact Wrestling in the last couple of weeks. They are trying to cut costs left, right, and center. So much so that it's affecting other parts of Anthem's business, which is not healthy for Anthem and the Fight Network. So we'll see what happens. But there's been more talent releases this week. The Hebner family have gone. The referees have gone. One of the other referees, I can't remember his name, the African-American gentleman. Do you know his name, sir?
No, I don't.
Yeah, he was working for free and transporting himself to shows, and he chose to leave. You know, so it's like, oh
yeah. And of course, coming up, you know, they're gonna have to do something with the authority figures, because JC won't be on these tapings.
No, he can't, because he can't go to Canada. Jim Cornette has had so many legal issues at the Canadian border in the past that when he was working for WWE, they had to kind of like have a chat with the embassy and try and sort out his visa issues. And of course, he doesn't work for WWE anymore, so therefore he doesn't have an in at the embassy, so he can't really transport himself to Canada. So until they bring tapings back to the US, which are expensive because Anthem's in Canada, we'll have to see what happens there. But yeah, so with JC gone for a while, maybe we think that other people are coming back and going, but again, it seems like they're probably going to change the direction of the company again at the next TV taping, depending on what talent they have, and depending on what guys they've got, and depending on what writers they have. So yeah, we'll see.
It's like a new wave or something, isn't it?
All right, the match 6. Gail Kim defeats Sienna and Ali in a 3-way match for the Impact Knockouts Championship in 9 minutes and 40 seconds. And the only thing I've got to say about this is, why wasn't this the main event? It's Gail Kim's, essentially Gail Kim's retirement match, and it should have been the main event. She has done more for the company. She's a bigger draw than Eli Drake and Johnny Impact are for the company, let's be honest, I think, anyway. So I don't see why this shouldn't have been the main event. And again, it stole the show from the last two matches, because it was better than the last two matches, just like last year's was. This was not as good as the Maria Kanellis Gail Kim match from last year's Bound for Glory wasn't a great wrestling match, but it was a great story. This one was a bit cloudy because it was a 3-way, and again, I think probably a 1-on-1 between Sienna and Gail Kim would have done better. But for what it was good for what it was, and certainly Ali had a real good, shining, strong wrestling performance, which she hasn't had for a long while because she's been a non-wrestler turning into a wrestler, even though we know all along she's actually one of the best wrestlers in North America. So, Marcus, what do you think of this, and do you agree with me that it should have been the main event? You don't have to.
I mean, no, I do agree, because that goes back to just, I think this whole thing with Gail Kim's retirement really hasn't had the gravitas that it should have.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much that has been just to the lack of the storytelling with her, or the lack of her being able to, I guess, kind of get out there, because I don't necessarily know where her health is. I don't know if she's been going at 100% since we've seen her on these shows. But, you know, and I said this to someone else, I would have preferred, you know, if they couldn't give her this grand going out, at least have her do some type of, you know, Kurt Angle type of thing, where she kind of tries to go through the best of her division and then finally get to Sienna, or do a thing where you have her, you know, having doubt if she could even get it done, and kind of taking some losses and having some lack of confidence in herself, and having just Sienna kind of just prey on that and then build to a singles match, which again would have benefited, you know, this overall card a lot more. but they didn't do that, and they kind of, you know, threw Allie in there, and I appreciate Allie. I always have, but, you know, it just would have been served better as a one-on-one because I think Sienna could have also benefited from some stronger stuff because I think she's kind of taken a back seat at times when the names like Rosemary and Taya have clashed.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think she would have benefited from that as well. But, you know, that's not what happened. But, you know, it was a solid outing by all three of these women. Sienna put in a lot of effort, and Allie and Gail did her thing. And, yeah, Gail at least went out on top. I don't think this last one is going to be the most remembered thing in her time in the company overall in her career. But she did go out on top, and she deserves it.
Yeah, definitely. Right then, the semi-main event. Lashley and King Mo defeat Moose and Stephen Bonner in 10 minutes and 40 seconds of the worst cage match I've ever watched in my life. God, this was dreadful. Right, here's the thing, and it's quite a big thing. Mixed martial artists don't sell to wrestling audiences. They just don't. Unless you've got guys you're going to train to be wrestlers, like Brock Lesnar, Ken Shamrock, Dan Severn. If they're just mixed martial artists who can do MMA-style stuff, they have no hope of whatsoever being useful to you in a wrestling ring. And this match was exactly that, because Lashley and Moose showed them up for athleticism quite regularly through this match, because they were doing a regular wrestling match. And then Mo and Bonner come in, and they kind of try and do some wrestling style stuff, but it doesn't work in this environment because none of the audience know what the hell's happening because they want to see a wrestling match. So the live crowd's dead. The match is not interesting to watch. It's full of interference, and the basic principle of a cage match, Impact Wrestling, I know you've ignored this advice in the past, but I'll explain it again in the one day the hope that you might understand how to book this. The point of a cage match is that no one can interfere. So what the hell was American Top Team doing in the cage with the wrestlers, thus negating the point of having a cage match? It was rubbish. Sorry, Marcus, what do you think of this?
Again, trying to shine any positive light on it. I appreciate the effort, and I knew it was going to be a hodgepodge of something. I didn't know what that something was going to turn out to be. Appreciate Moose always trying to turn up the aesthetics for these big shows entrance wise, but that rap was dreadful. and this is coming from somebody who appreciates certain form of rap, but
I like hip hop too. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't work with that, but you know, like I said, I appreciate the effort for the turning up for big shows, but with this case, like you said, it was just awkward because obviously they're confined already as it is, and then you got these MMA fighters in there, but at the same time it's like they're not going to have too much interaction with the wrestlers because, you know, it's a clash of styles. And so they kept doing this weird thing where obviously, you know, they would have interaction with the wrestlers, but mostly they'd be getting beat up by either Moose or Lashley. And then Moose or Lashley will take each other out, and then finally they, you know, get together, and then they're, you know, trading, you know, submissions and strikes and whatnot. And it kind of just, it was just awkward watching it. And,
yeah.
And then you got America Top Team who, you had to know coming into this match if there wasn't going to be, you know, barred or anything, who the advantage would be in, and that's kind of the way it went. So, you know, the numbers game fell as they normally do, and with any cage match in wrestling, for some reason, trying to keep people out never works, specifically in Impact, where we've seen some of the most egregious things with the cage, specifically in the days of Aces and Eights, and obviously everybody remembers that whole thing with Joe and Abyss.
Yeah.
So, their cage match record is flimsy at best. So, you know, this match was what it was, and they went with the only logical result because one side just had more numbers anyway.
Six sides of disappointment.
I guess that'll be a great title for this
episode. Bound for Glory, Six Sides of Disappointment. All right, then we move on to the main event of the evening, Eli Drake and Chris Adonis. What's the point in Chris Adonis? Just, I'm going to stop it here. Before we talk about this match, why do we have Chris Adonis? Does he just need a job?
I feel the exact same way. I see no point. Drake can absolutely hang on his own. I've never been a huge fan of Adonis. I don't know why he's
there. Why is he there?
They don't know him.
Just what? he's less use than Josh Matthews. Anyway.
And I thought Drake's thing with Tyrus was bad.
Yeah, but at least Tyrus had some, like, presence about him. Like, yes. Adonis is a black hole of personality. You know, he detracts from what Eli Drake can do. Anyway, sorry, apologies. 19 minutes and 30 seconds of a pretty entertaining match that was ruined by Alberto Pel Patron coming in and doing a run-in in the main event finish where he hit the referee, he hits Drake with a chair, he hits Johnny Impact with the belt. Then he hits them all again with a chair, and eventually he decides that Johnny Impact's going to lose, so he puts Eli Drake on top of Johnny Impact. The referee comes to and counts three, and there's your championship win.
Oh, another perfectly good match, main event, big title match in Impact Wrestling, main event in the show that was absolutely shat on by unnecessary interference and unnecessary overbooking.
Yes, this was like, why did you bother? So the biggest match of your biggest show of the year means nothing. So why should we spend money buying pay-per-views? Why should we spend money investing in your company if you're going to treat everything like a TV taping? You know, there is no payoff. There was very little payoff to this anyway, because Johnny Impact or John Morrison or Johnny Mundo, depending on where he is, has not been there long enough to create enough momentum to have a big payoff with this match. But it was a championship match, and they'd done it more or less properly, and it was cool, and I was kind of looking forward to it, and the match itself was very good for what it was, and it kind of proves that Eli Drake is a worthy champion, and you know, he can carry the belt. He wasn't ready when he first started, definitely not, but now he's kind of in his stride, and then you go and ruin it with this heel nobody really is interested in that is, you know, costing you money hand over fist when he's not going to be that interesting to watch, and it ruins the match, and it ruins your entire pay-per-view's point. You know, Bound for Glory, what's less glory than this?
Yeah, and to be honest, this was the second thing the man ruined of the night. the second thing he ruined. I mean, he killed the crowd, and he came out, and then he killed this match, and it's like, look, man, I never want to shout on these talents, but it's like I've never been really into El Patron, ever. Mm. You know, this whole time in WWE, he was just a guy that was there, served his purpose. Then he got in, you know, he transitioned into the independence. He came to Lucha Underground, and he sparked some interest, but then that fell through. So he came back to WWE. That was absolutely atrocious. And now he's here, and I don't want him to be champion. I don't want him to have, you know, these big, you know, spotlights of the shows, but because of everything he's done, he's like one of the biggest names, and unfortunately guys like Drake suffer from it, because stuff like this kind of reminds me of that horrible title run that was Magnus's.
Yeah.
And all that overbooked, just unnecessary stuff, and the champion never really got to show what they could do, and we know what Drake is capable of, we just have to let him do it. So hopefully, you know, by the time his reign comes to an end, the biggest thing takeaway won't be El Patron.
No, so. We hope not. You know, so yeah, and it just like to contrast this against other companies around the world that we've seen. You know, like Cody Rhodes has gone to Ring of Honor, and he looks like a Ring of Honor wrestler, and he's representing the company, has their heel world champion. That's how you do it right. I'm not the biggest fan of Cody, but Ring of Honor have done a good job with presenting him as the face of the company. You know, and you contrast this with El Patron here, he's the wrong guy in the wrong spot, and no one cares about him enough to deliver this properly. I mean, if we go back to Slammiversary, when he was champion and wrestling Bobby Lashley, I really could care less. I was more into watching Lashley, the heel, than I was watching him. You know, so it is just like, this, it's just not working. And I don't understand why they're so desperate to have him.
I guess it goes back to the name value thing, but we've been through this before. You had a whole era of you know, TNA where they, you know, was bringing in a bunch of guys simply for name value, and they used it as, you know, basically a timeshare. They used their time with your company as a timeshare and an easy check.
Yeah.
So, I don't get it when you got guys like Drake and the EC3s and you know, guys like Jesse Goddard, who is literally just off doing his own thing. And you got guys like that, and you don't push them to the forefront. And by the time you do, it's like it's too late.
Yeah, that's so it.
It never works.
I mean, Eli Drake has been there, what, 3 or 4 years now? And he's had like a rocket to the moon compared to other people, but that's mainly because other people have dropped by the wayside or have left the company or gone somewhere else. And but he was a guy who was, I know Ben Spindler can't stand him, but however, I think he's really, really good. And I think he's got the delivery, he's got the timing, he's got everything to be a great Impact Wrestling champion. I wouldn't stick the belt on him in WWE. But, you know, in this particular context, I think he's really, really good at what he does. And, you know, it cost them a tenth of what it costs. The development process for Eli Drake was a lot quicker and a lot cheaper than signing Alberto El Patron and sticking him in the main event with no build-up, with no audience development. They have no ownership over him. He's just another guy from another company. And they've proved it time and time again. If they build their own stars like EC3, Eli Drake, James Storm, Eddie Edwards to an extent, Gail Kim, Sienna, Ali, the really popular ones are the ones that have been in the company, have had a story that you've got your teeth into.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, you put it perfectly. There's a good argument to be made had it had the proper bill. Obviously, that Triple Threat Women's could have main evented the show, but even before that, the match that I was looking most forward to, and I think a lot of people were, that didn't happen, was Rosemary and Valkyrie.
Yeah, yeah.
And that could have semi-main evented the show, to be honest. But yeah, we're going to have to, you know, finish that sometime really down the road, because I don't even think Taya can come back till, what, after January?
Yeah, yeah. She's dealing with issues at the moment, isn't she? So that's the word. But it is just, yeah, it's like good booking is cheaper than talent. It just is. If you've got cheap talent and book them correctly, you don't need the big names. You know, it takes you longer. You have to invest more time in it. And yes, you do need a couple of big names. Okay. And just to prove us, by the way, it isn't just us. I'm looking at this Wikipedia page, and it's got a section called reception. On it, there is a list of what other journalists, aside from us, thought. Larry Sonka of 411 Mania put it as bad, 3 out of 10. Adam Martin of Wrestle Review wrote Bound for Glory disappoints in Ottawa. The pacing of the show was really bad. Pro Wrestling Touch, 3 out of 10. Jason Powell of ProWrestling.net, a poor show with few redeeming qualities. You know, it's not just us. You don't have to listen to us. Other people will tell you how bad it was as well. It is just like, me and you have been saying, just hang in there, it'll get better and better. And we've tried. And one of the reasons why we've stopped talking about Impact Wrestling lately is because we were sick of having to go say, it'll get better.
Yeah.
You know, we were just like, we're honest. You know, it's like, we will call it like we see it. And what we see at the minute is a product that isn't worth watching. I watch it every week because it's my shot of mainstream wrestling. But again, I'm sick of the recaps. I'm sick of storylines that don't go anywhere. I'm sick of not knowing whether the talent will be there the following week to finish the storyline off, or if it'll all just disappear in the puff of smoke, because it reminds me too much of WCW in the 90s, and they had money. So, you know, it's just, I am concerned for the company, because the more places there are to work, I want them as there as much as I possibly can. And I want them there for the audience, because it's good for wrestling. But it's hard to defend something this bad.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm usually, you know, it's funny that Ben calls us the brighter side, seeing the brighter side of everything, because usually you are the one more critiquey on this stuff, and then I try to come in with the sunny side. But at this point, even I can't defend this stuff. I can't even defend it. I watch this stuff every week. I've been watching for years, and just seeing all these regime changes and all this top talent leaving, and obviously for great reasons. Because they want us to thrive. But, you know, just all this stuff, and there's always a changeover of something, or something, like you said, something happens with the talent and the storyline has to fall through. It's always something. It can never just get on a consistent road and stick there. And that speaks to both the business side with the company and, unfortunately, the storylines on screen. So it's just, you kind of just, even when something positive is going on a consistent level, of any consistent level, you're almost waiting for the other shoe to drop, and you shouldn't feel like that for a company that's been operating for, what, 14 years now?
Yeah, yeah. This show is just tone deaf, badly timed, misplaced, missing notes left, right, and center, booked in the wrong order, the wrong matches with the wrong people, or the right matches in the wrong place. There's bits in there, and there's, you know, that Tyson Ducks Ishimori match was perfectly fine, but it should have been three times longer. and the Monsters Ball match should have been 10 minutes. You know, we could rebook this now when we can make it 10 times better. You just stick the Knockouts three-way into the main event. You move the tag team match into the second main event. You put Eli Drake and Johnny Impact in the middle so you can have your fluff ending and you still got still going to send the fans I'm happy. You know, just fix it.
Yeah, and you remove anybody with the A. You just remove them. It's not necessary. Save that for one of these Impacts that's upcoming, but this is your biggest show of the year, and you put him in the middle of it, and it kills the crowd because some of them may not know him, and the other half just didn't give a damn to hear what he had to say.
No, this is it. You know, there are wrestlers in this world who will just not get a proper reaction the way they want to in a certain front of a certain audience. I know certain wrestlers in certain promotions are blackballed by the fans because they hate them that much, you know, and they will just not listen. They'll boo them out of the building, and not in a, you know, Zach Gibson in progress booed because he's a bad guy kind of way and you can't hear what he says. I mean, like, you know, just the fans will just not react to them in any way. It'll be dead air, and they can't get jobs because of that, because they're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And this is one of those cases where you've had an entire card like this, and Alberto Belpatron just was the icing on the cake of insulting your audience, I guess, really. Well, that's that then. Yeah, we will be back after this musical interlude where we'll be looking at Power Struggle from New Japan Pro Wrestling. But in the meantime, thank you to my guest, Mr. Marcus Green, at Paradox Kid on Twitter.
Oh, man, thank you. Always a pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation a lot more than I did the actual show. So.
Plus, it wasn't 2.5 hours long. Okay, then, we'll be back after this musical interlude. Hello, and welcome back to the True Penny Show. Now, we did say we'd have some other guests, but unfortunately we don't. But it is 5 days later since we recorded the Bound for Glory review. We've had some coffee, we've sat down, we're feeling a lot better about ourselves, and the world can move on, can't it, Marcus?
Yeah, we've, like you said, we've had some coffee, we've had some time away, we've, some of us have prayed.
Yes, an intervention or two, and we feel better now.
Yep.
Yes. So we're going to move on to Power Struggle from New Japan Pro Wrestling, which occurred last Sunday. It was a very, 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 very good show in comparison to what we've just talked about. This was manna from heaven.
Yeah, that's what Shakespeare compared to, you know, our previous show.
This was Shakespeare compared to, I don't know, Cannonball, which is a joke Marcus won't get, but Alex Sy and the other Alex will be laughing their heads off. Anyway, we'll start with Dave Finley. He wrestled Katsuyo Kitamura in 5 minutes and 32 seconds in a dark match. It was a lot of fun for what it was, the usual Young Boys match. But, you know, Dave Finley, I've been slightly concerned about because he started with a bang and has gone slightly downhill this year in his run. But this was good for what it was. Kitamura is big and lumpy and shows an amazing amount of flexibility for the amount of muscles he has on him. No sign of slowing down yet, but I'm still concerned that he will do himself an injury. We will see. Marcus, what did you think of this opener?
Yeah, like you said, a fun little match. Obviously, Dave Finley is has come a long way as a great talent, and Katamura is, you know, it's kind of like Don Callis, I think, said on commentary. He has all the tools. He just got to bring everything together. Somebody that young with that those gifts, if you will, you know, physically, can sometimes be a little bit overzealous, and I think we kind of see him going through that stage right now as a young lion, but. You know, he's got all the tools, and he's putting them together slowly but surely each time we see him. And having him go against somebody like Dave Finley, who, like you said, just kind of lost some momentum in the grand shuffle of things. But it's great for spots like this, going against somebody like Katsumura, who's up and coming. Like you said, a fun little 5 minutes some match, and great show of sportsmanship at the end.
Yeah, definitely. They had a hug and a walk-off, and Dave, who was a young boy not that long ago, encouraged Kitamura, which is really, really cool. Be interesting to see what Kitamura looks like after 18 months doing the excursions with Ring of Honor and CMLL. We'll see what he's made of. And then we had a tag team match, which was ranked 3.25 stars by your Dave Meltzer, 5.79 by the Cage Match users. Young Bucks, Matt and Nick Jackson make their grand return to New Japan Pro Wrestling, where they take on the CMLL team of Dragon Lee and Titan in 7 minutes and 18 seconds. of spots all over the place, flying around the ring like there's no tomorrow, as you'd expect with these four guys. But it was a fun, fun match, and it ended with the new submission finisher from the Young Bucks, which is a combined sharpshooter and crossface, which looks particularly vicious, but I'm concerned about the legality of it. Marcus, what did you think of this?
Which is the point. You got a lot of Bucks. You got a lot of these guys, no matter, you know, not even draped in as much gold as we usually see them in, they're equally as entertaining. I mean, these guys just constantly keep the momentum going. Again, another New Japan match that, when you go back and look at it, it seems short for the time, but they always find a way to make the most of it. And like you said, this was another great match. Titan and Dragon Lee is a great tag team. I'm not as familiar with Titan, but he's obviously a great talent, and Dragon Lee is phenomenal. So I thought it was a great contrast against the Bucks style, who can be more aerial, and like you said, just get their spots in. But they're technical when they want to be, and they've shown it a lot more in New Japan, specifically with this new submission, which is a big middle finger to the WWE, which is, to be honestly, hassle that they've given these guys, the cease and desist, which is true irony, like two ways for me, because that's usually something you will get in a triple threat match when two guys put it on one guy, which always seemed kind of just really shenanigans to me, because it's like, okay, this isn't going to end the way anybody wants it to, because the ref is going to kind of double tap out. So for them to have that in submission, I think is great. And before the match, for one of the Bucks to be like, we're on that Undertaker schedule or the Brock Lesnar schedule. It was great. They were walking back and around like, we don't need to have, you know, these exorbitant long matches. We only do the big shows. We come in, we beat them, and we leave. So those guys are just great. And like I said, you know, Dragon Lee and Titan are a great tag. And while I've not been as immersed in it, and I think they've done a tag league recently, or has it just been the Junior's tournament?
That's why, they've just been on the tournament for the last couple of weeks. That's why they're on the tour.
Yeah, so while I've not caught all of that, it's great to see these pairings. So another fun opener.
Yeah, it's basically that finisher is just there to annoy Jim Cornette even more, really.
Yes.
That's the only reason why it exists. But it was a really interesting interview on The Art of Wrestling this week with Young Bucks and Kenny Omega, where they talked about this stuff, and they actually talked about their relationship with Jim Cornette, and they'd say that, you know, we understand he's playing a character just like we do, and he said that's all we're doing, and he said it's actually done us some good, and it's probably done him some good, so we'll keep doing it. Okay, we next moved on to the 10-man tag match, which was Hiroki Kawato, Juice Robinson, Justin Thunder Liger, Kushida, and Tiger Mask, who defeated Suzuki Gun, El Desperado, Tai Chi, go home Tai Chi, Taka Michinoku, Yoshinobu Nakamura, and Zack Sabre Jr. in 5 minutes and 19 seconds. This was pretty fun for what it was. As usual, everybody got their stuff in. Kawato was encouraged greatly by Juice Robinson. I love Kawato. Kawato's going to be ace when he comes back off excursion. I've no idea what he's going to do, but it's going to be awesome. 5 minutes, 19 seconds, just plain good old-fashioned fun. What do you think of this, Marcus?
Yeah, agreed. Like you said, good old-fashioned fun. Everybody got their stuff in. It was good to see some combinations, I think, between Liger and Mask, in the early goings. And in these situations, you usually don't see guys kind of get over on Suzuki Gun. So, it was, like I said, a fun opener. It's good to see my boy Juice in the mix with the legends. So, fun, another fun excursion.
Yeah, definitely. And, usually we do see Suzuki Gun dominant in these tag matches, but it was definitely Taka's not having, there was some consultation there that Taka was not pulling his weight, that the veteran second-in-commander Suzuki Gun needs to take a long, hard look at himself. So we'll see what happens there. The next match was a six-man tag match, which pitted Tenkoji, Hiroshi Tenzan, Satoshi Kojima, the greatest IWGP tag team champions of all time, with Togi Makabe, and they defeat a Bullet Club trio of Chase Owens, Cody, and Yujihiro Takahashi in 8 minutes and 11 seconds, again in a fun, fun match. And Chase Owens was gorgeous in this match. I loved his stuff. Cody was very, very good as well, and Yujiro is Yujiro, but the slick double teams of Tenkoji and the outright brutality of Togi Makabe went out. What did you think of this, Marcus?
Again, same. kind of similar to the other tag match. We usually don't see, you know, Suzuki Gunner or Bullet Club, you know, take the L in these situations just because they, you know, you see the chemistry with these teams. But like you said, between Tenzan and Kojima, you know, great tag team, and then you know, you add in Makabe, and that's quite a formidable pairing right there. So, you know, while Owens has some great stuff, Cody is always slick with his stuff. And like you said, Yujiro is just Yujiro. Again, thanks for the entrance. yeah, I mean, it's just another fun outing. And, you know, again, elevated with the time, 8 minutes and 11 seconds, giving these guys more to do who can do a lot in a little bit of time. Like I said, not usual to see Bullet Club take an L, but rightfully so when you have the pairing that they were against.
I did ask Kevin Kelly on Twitter this week to stop using the phrase "it's Yujiro from behind" because no one needs to have that image in their head.
Thanks for that. I didn't even catch that, but yeah that's
he did like the comments, and hopefully we won't have to have that again.
Hilarious, something like that coming from Kelly, because usually that's the guy he's being paired with.
Yeah, it was fun. And to be fair to Callis, he was actually very, very good on this show. I actually enjoyed him a lot better this month. I think he's found his groove. I think he was just trying too hard, to be honest with you, in previous months, and he's now got it down to a fine art of how to call these matches and get everybody over. Wasn't Owa keen on his mental health talk about Torriano, but we'll get to that in time. Yeah. Next, we get on to the meat of the matter, the Super Junior Tag Team 2017 final match, which depicted Rapingi 3K, Sho and Yo, against ACH and Raisuke Taguchi. And Sho and Yo take the championship in 15 minutes and 55 seconds, so 51 seconds. It was a really, really good match, and Sho and Yo are being showcased at the moment. They are getting the push. And well-deserved, too. They've worked really, really hard. ACH comes back to the final 2 years running, but still doesn't take home the big prize. And Raisuke Taguchi was really on fire, actually showing much more effort, I thought, than his tag team with Ricochet. Him and ACH have really gelled well together on short notice. If you're wondering where Ricochet is, he was in Japan that particular weekend, but he was doing his farewell tour with DDT, his old home promotion, before he moved up to New Japan Pro Wrestling. Let's see where he ends up. I think I've got a pretty good idea where he's going. Marcus, what do you think of this tournament final?
I thought it was really good. For me, this was kind of my introduction to Roppongi 3K. Obviously, coming off the last big New Japan show, we had kind of got the ending to, you know, Roppongi Vice. They went out really good. And obviously, Romero has kind of been busy and foretold of the coming of a group that will be even better than Roppongi Vice. And I saw them on Twitter, but I had never seen them in action. So for me, this was my first time seeing Sho and Yo, and really good, man, really young. You know, two guys are really, really good dynamic, I think. You know, shout out to Romero for the scouting. I think this is a really good pairing. And they, you know, they really put in the work specifically against somebody like ACH Super 69. that name's kind of okay, but. Yeah, I mean, great, you know, good storytelling this match. Obviously, ACH is a very dynamic performer, but, you know, you have an injury on a guy like that, and you work it, and you kind of get what we got here. And I thought Sho and Yo really worked him over. And obviously, Taguchi, like you said, he's maybe he looked better because he was tasked to do more. Maybe I think when he's in his tag team with, you know, Ricochet, you can kind of rely on a guy like Ricochet because of how talented he is. That, you know, Taguchi would normally, I guess, be in the spot of ACH, but it's kind of, they kind of flipped the tables here, which is a great thing because obviously ACH is going to do what he do when he's 100%, but Taguchi was allowed to show more, even in defeat. So, like I said, this is my introduction to Roppongi Vice, and I really like these guys. It'll be interesting to see them go, I guess, eventually down the line against the Bucks. So.
Yeah, that was the big takeaway from this match. At the end of the match, as there was no championship defense on this show, because obviously Rapingi 3K are the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champions, the Young Bucks came down and said, "We want our belts back." So that's the match for Wrestle Kingdom 12 on January 4th in the Tokyo Dome. Rapingi 3K, that was the first match to be finalized, aside from the IWGP Heavyweight Championship match. So we move then on to a 10-man tag match, which featured Chaos versus Los Ignorables. De Japón, Gedo, Hiroki Goto, Kazuchika Okada, Tomohiro Ishii, and Yoshihashi defeat Bushi, Evil, Hiromu Takahashi, Sanada, and Tetsuya Naito in 12 minutes and 7 seconds in a very, very classy mixed tag match, which really told the story of Okada trying to get back on top against Tetsuya Naito, and certainly Chaos trying to stamp some authority after being chased out the building by LIJ all summer long. The tide is starting to turn in the LIJ Chaos War, which kind of like tells some story to lead us into Wrestle Kingdom 12. So this was an incredibly important match, even though it's one of those 10 tag matches you tend to ignore. This told you an awful lot about what's going to happen at Wrestle Kingdom, and it was a lot of fun, a well-told story, and showed a lot more cohesiveness and teamwork from Chaos than I've seen in a long time. Marcus, what's your thoughts on this?
I mean, I you know, I don't know if I could put it any better than you did. I mean, obviously, like you said, you coming out of the G1 and just seeing the hell that Okada had to go through with that, because a lot of times he was taking L's. And in fact, LIJ was basically dominant for most of that tournament and shows leading up to that, you know, on the tours, just giving it to Chaos and taking it to, you know, Okada. Oftentimes leading up to his match with Evil just, you know, really, you know, going over on him and just getting the best of him. But here it was really great, like you said, more cohesion with Chaos. Shout out to my boy Goto. You know, Ishii is always just going to be the great Ishii. But Okada, I think this is the big takeaway for me. Okada really looked dominant. And just the way he kind of took charge and won in dominant fashion and got a defiant Rainmaker at the end, just showing the champion that he is and showing that he's not just going to be pushed around, you know, no matter how many L's he can take just because he's been such a phenomenal champion. But he really, like you said, the tide is turning and he really looked good, and the cohesion with Chaos is improved, which is very much to their benefit, because I think that's a lot of the reason why they've taken such slack from LIJ, is because just LIJ has just had more better cohesion. Even though Chaos has some really good names, that cohesion plays a great part. So just the tie turn here, I think, was great. And like you said, playing off up until leading up to Wrestle Kingdom, which already has the card of the year and is like months away. So yeah, just some really good stuff and storytelling throughout this whole Chaos LIJ saga, really.
Yeah, it's been fascinating for me. And what really does fascinate me is they still hate Naito in Osaka.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that great tweet. And shout out to Kevin Kelly again. Great commentary.
Yeah, yeah.
Bringing us, U.S. fans into that, and why this. Because really, Naito's thing has really just been an evolution of a character, and rightfully so, because, you know, he was that guy, you know, trying to do things the right way, and obviously the fans didn't necessarily see it that way, and he turned into the guy that would, you know, get a legacy belt and tarnish it, you know, and do things in spite of everything, and he's climbed the ranks to be one of the best in the company because of it. And but yeah, you know, keeping that hate, and I think that's twofold, him and the fans, because they won't let it go, and neither will he.
yeah,
it's just a great combination of stuff.
It really is. I mean, it does depend. People don't realize this. Japan is city by city, the fans change very much so. Like any wrestling anywhere in the world, the fans in Philadelphia are very, very different to the fans in New York. But in Japan, it's, you don't necessarily expect that, because there is always that stereotype of traditional quiet Japanese crowd. And Osaka are the traditional quiet Japanese crowd. But if they don't like you, they will let you know. And Naito, they were the first ones to turn on Naito when they didn't see him as the guy, you know, who was being pushed down the throats. It was the John Cena, Roman Reigns thing, really. And but instead of, like, trying to keep going with it and trying to turn the fans, New Japan went with it and turned Naito instead. And it has worked so, so well. He is loved in Tokyo, you know, and Tokyo fans hated him for a long while. Tokyo fans really, really hated him. If you go back to his Never Openweight Championship defense against Tomohiro Ishii, the fans love Ishii and they hate Naito. They despise him, and Naito's the face. And back then, Chaos hadn't turned face then. They were still heels. You know, it was part of the thing that turned Chaos face, really, because the fans loved the fans loved Ishii, the fans loved Okada, the fans loved Nakamura, and they loved Yano, so they had to turn them face, you know. So that was part of the whole chaos turn, and the reason why LAG exists is because the fans in Osaka hated him first. So there you go. Right. Speaking of Toriyano, he made his championship challenge to Minoru Suzuki in a bull rope death match in 15 minutes and 21 seconds. In a fun as match as this is going to be, the Yano-Suzuki feud, after 4 years, continues to burn brightly like a never-ending story. Never-ending story. Sorry. this was hilarious. This is just fun. This is exactly what I expected it to be. Interference left, right, and center, and it stands out. You know, Minoru Suzuki has said the deathmatch stipulations in each of the Never Open Weight Championships is to make the title stand out, to give it its own style and be something different, and that's what we got here, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Wrong guy won. Sorry, Suzuki fans, but Toriyano for the win. What do you think, Marcus Green?
Yeah, agreed. You know, this coming into this match, I was just, you know, even before this, I was like I tweeted a while back, just pray for Yano because messing with Suzuki is like, what, are you insane? And not even talking about anything that Don Callis had to say about, you know, Yano's mental. It's just, you can see this guy's not to be messed with. I mean, you know, just talk to any, you know, young boy by ringside. You know, he's tortured these guys and made it a staple, all really. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't expecting too much coming, you know, into this, because, you know, Suzuki is a destroyer, and Yano, you know, while very entertaining and very solid in that ring, it's just two different leagues. But, you know, shout out to Yano switching up the look. It's definitely new for me. Obviously, it's a throwback for longtime New Japan fans. But he switched it up, had attitude change. He went for the, I think, the low blow even before the bell, or he attacked him before the bell, which is smart. People thinking that this wasn't going to spill to the outside for some reason. Obviously has never seen a Suzuki match. It's gonna go to the outside. I don't even know if he would have been able to do this if he couldn't go outside. So you know, I thought, even with the bull rope situation, they really told some great stuff, specifically Suzuki getting really technical with the way he used that rope. I'm usually just used to seeing him just kind of brutalize his opponents. But he really got methodical with the way he used and abused Yano with that bull rope, which kind of was refreshing for me, because it is a lot of times Suzuki's style to just beat the guy up in the crowd, and then we get some stuff in the ring. But most of the stuff in the ring is kind of overshadowed by interference, which we, of course, did get. I mean, it's a Suzuki match, which, you know, LIJ is not far behind. But yeah, I thought Yano did about as good as you could do against Suzuki in this kind of match. He fought like hell, but he went down in flames.
Yeah, I just loved it. I just love the Sublime Master Feith. I am so, so happy that he got his championship shot, even if he lost. It was so much fun to watch. And hopefully it won't be too long till he gets another championship shot. That's my... Everyone else is going, no! And I was like, you're wrong. He's just awesome. All right, then. The next match was for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Championship match. The first defense for Will Ospreay in his first championship reign, and a 5.25-star match from Meltzer. Cage Match users rated it 6.76. It was 17 minutes and 28 seconds long, but Marty Scurll takes the championship for Bullet Club, costing Chaos its current Junior Heavyweight Championship. This was fantastic. This is the kind of match my dad would love. Okay, this is proper British wrestling in a British style. Will didn't fly around as much. He kind of had that offense taken off of him. And there's big spots that he put in there, like the moonsault onto Marty, who was hung over the top rope. They were big, big spots, but they were spread out through the whole match, so it made them even more impactful. He wasn't having to go as fast. And Marty, doing the mat work and all the heel stuff, this was just sublime. I absolutely adored this match. Marcus, what did you think?
Same. I love these two. I love this match, and I even love, you know, more than just the match itself, the story with the match. And again, you know, shout out to Don Callis and Kevin Kelly for, you know, bringing fans who might not be as familiar with the history between these two into the match. Because it really is just, essentially, Marty Scurll is the phantom of Will Ospreay's wrestling opera. For me, and you know, just telling that great story, because everybody doesn't watch, you know, every single big wrestling event, specifically with the indies, because it's just so much stuff being, you know, integrated from the mainstream companies. But, you know, just telling that story of every time Ospreay has essentially peaked in a certain promotion, here comes Skrull to knock him off his perch. And then him essentially, you know, really twofold, taking away his accolades and kind of cutting some of his confidence, because you know, where Ospreay's game is that aerial style, and Marty Skrull is the complete opposite of that. So, you know, just a great contrast in that way, and because of it, it made for a really great match. Because if you know, obviously I'm not one of the guys that crapped all over the Ricochet and Ospreay matches, but yeah, that type of outing is for a certain type of wrestling fan. But me, I'm also, while I like that, I'm also appreciated this because it slowed it down. You can catch everything. And to me, this was kind of the best of these two, but specifically for Skrull, because like I said, he's really, you know, really been a spoiler a lot of times for Ospreay, and it continued here telling that story, in a great way that New Japan always does, just keeping the momentum going with story. And, yeah, he got the surprise and win to me, and it wasn't in a dominant fashion. He literally caught him, you know, with a pin. So, just great stuff. But this match was phenomenal, but even it peaked again after, because once again, wrestling gave me something that I didn't even know I wanted. And it's all because of Hiromu Takahashi. And I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah. After the match, Kushida came down to challenge Marty Skrull. With the glorious "I challenge you, motherfucker." To which Will Ospreay said, "Would you jump in me fucking grave so fast?" It's like the most Japanese and British and American of insults, but
it was just so good. And Marty Skrull, and I almost want to take this from him, or borrow it, I should say. Just, I see you've come to spot a bit of
you come to cause a spot of bother.
Yes, you come to cause a spot of bother. I love that. That is so British. I love it, because I was watching Ring of Honor last night, and he used it on Jay Lethal, who apparently he's going to be facing it. He called out for Final Battle.
Right.
So, I mean, just great stuff. My boy Kushida just going all out, and then, you know, the three of them, and then freaking Hiromu comes out. And probably the greatest moment on this show, on a show that had phenomenal wrestling, freaking Hiromu comes out, will not be knocked out because he's wearing like a goalie mask.
Was it a lacrosse goalie mask?
Yeah, a lacrosse goalie mask. Will not have his fingers broken because he's wearing mittens. And I think it was matching his outfit.
Yes, it was.
And he just got the ring. And this is coming from a guy who's seen Hiromu, specifically during his time in ROH, was my introduction to him. And then seeing him in New Japan having that great feud with my boy Kushida. But I wasn't necessarily a Hiromu guy, and I'm fully on board now, because now, to me, this made him to me as adorable as Daryl ever was. This was just phenomenal in every sense of the word. And the fact that we're getting a four-way out of this at Wrestle Kingdom, which you rarely get in New Japan, which makes things like that mean more, hint, hint, WWE.
Hint, hint, Impact Wrestling, as they proved earlier in our show. Yes. Karen.
So, yeah, Non-Stop Global Force Impact, that was a shot at you. But yeah, I mean, it was just phenomenal match, and top it off with, you know, like I said, that great segment was great. Loved everything about it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I'm really looking forward to that four way, and I don't like four ways, but this one I think will be really, really good because they know what they're doing. So we'll see. I can't imagine this is going to be two guys waiting on the outside to catch spots. This is going to be really, really cool. All right then. The next match was a 4.5-star, bit of a classic here. Kenny Omega defeats Beretta in his first heavyweight championship match. 21 minutes and 33 seconds. Now, the story of this match was Omega kind of taking Beretta lightly, and then Beretta coming back with a fire. these two nearly killed each other. Let's be honest. There were so many big bumps in this match. There was Snapdragon suplexes that just looked so vicious. Beretta took some big bumps on the apron and some really awkward landings. Omega did the same. But eventually, Kenny Omega wins the championship and takes the title home again. And we'll talk about the surprise at the end afterwards. This was something very special indeed. And I'll be quite honest, I love Trent Beretta, but I didn't think he had this in him. Marcus, what did you think of this?
Yeah, again, another phenomenal outing. It's funny to me. Yeah, Kenny's kind of becoming, I mean, obviously he's one of the best in the world, but he's really becoming this proven post for guys like Beretta and, you know, even my boy Juice.
Yeah.
He's really, you know, becoming, supplying that proving ground for these guys, which I think is phenomenal because guys like Juice and Beretta are uber talented, but because, you know, in certain instances, they're seen in such a certain vein, specifically Beretta coming out of Roppongi, and Romero being very wise about, you know, picking his spots and doing a lot, but he's more so a personality, if anything. So, you know, for Beretta to really try to break out and, you know, push this whole heavyweight thing, there's no one better for him to go against than Omega. And again, like Juice did in the G1, and obviously, you know, in the title match after that, really showing and prove, like you said, Omega is a guy who's battle tested, battle ready, and Beretta kind of has to, he had to meet him. He had to meet him where he was, up his game, if you will. Kenny, just being Kenny, you know, showmanship along with his technique, you know, here's Kenny with the table spot and everything, which, again, he has his own table spot now, which I think is great. But yeah, I didn't expect this out of Beretta. I've never really been a big Beretta fan, but he really impressed me with this outing, you know, kind of showing shades of his time in Roppongi Vice, because he really became, I guess you could say, the workhorse of that, because he take a lot of the offense.
Yeah.
Those things really proving just how much damage he can take, and against a guy like Omega who was just like riddle your life with V triggers. You need that type of grit and that type of resolve, and Beretta showed that here. But again, even though he elevated his game, again showing that just Omega's just on a different level, but a phenomenal outing for Beretta.
I mean, the first time I saw Trent Beretta was actually in person 4 years ago in Grimsby, nice, of all places, at my local wrestling promotion. It was just after his WWE run. And he was in a Fatal 4-Way match with Robbie X, Johnny Kidd, and I can't remember who the other person was, to be honest with you, off the top of my head. But it was fantastic, and I loved watching him then. And then I've never realized how far he would come in those 4 years. And he's another one of those guys, he's kind of off the radar, but he's another one of those guys who's proved you don't need WWE to make a living, and you don't need WWE to become a big star. But there you go. It's okay.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. You know, Beretta's another one of those guys. Obviously, I saw him, you know, in his days in WWE, and obviously, you know, he left there and kind of got into the indies and then found Romero. And I think his time with Roppongi Vice really helped him. I don't know if he necessarily would be in the spot he is now if not for the vehicle of Roppongi Vice, where we saw him grow and really saw him kind of turn up his personality, having kind of meet Romero, who was just, you know, larger than life sometimes.
But
just really, you know, just a really great maturation for him to get to this point. And if he's really gonna, you know, be, you know, a heavyweight, you know, like I said, there's no one better than Kenny, and obviously, you know, he's gonna run into some other names. But this was just a great showing for him, like it was for Juice in the G1, and a lot of people are gonna be taking him a lot more serious, specifically Kenny, should they meet again. But you know, shout out to Beretta. Like I said, I really wasn't a huge fan. I've always appreciated the work. But, you know, when you put him in situations like this and seeing him able to elevate in such a way that makes him worthy to be on the stage with these top New Japan talents, it speaks volumes for how just how New Japan allows guys like this the opportunity to get over, if you will, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, definitely. And then at the end of the match, the Kenny gives his actually quite sporting promo at the end. Name-checking, yeah. Beretta, what an effort by young Trent Beretta. And he goes along with his goodbye, good night, click, and the lights go out. And then we get a video package. And that video package features one Chris Jericho, which you've probably heard about now unless you've been living under a rock. Chris Jericho will be challenging Kenny Omega for the IWGP United States Heavyweight Championship at Wrestle Kingdom 12 on January 4th in the Tokyo Dome. A match that has shook the wrestling world because everyone was under the general belief that Chris Jericho was still a WWE signee. Turns out he wasn't. He has been set loose from the Federation and is calling his own shots, and he's decided he's going to land in New Japan Pro Wrestling. This is going to be something very interesting. Now, there was a lot of consultation as it went through the week. People were saying this is going to be the match of the decade. And it's like, no, it's not. Because as much greatest will in the world, Chris Jericho is still 52 years old. And as much as I love the guy and what he's done for the pro wrestling business, he's not going to have the match of the year with Kenny Omega. That's not going to happen. You know, not when you've got Naito and Okada coming afterwards. No, but it is going to be absolutely fantastic. Marcus, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, agreed. And just one of the reasons why I love this so much, obviously, I'm a big fan of Jericho, everything he's done, and just to see him get better in the latter part of his career, you know, is ironic coming to New Japan where we get that, you know, as a regularity. But I thought it was great. I mean, again, a show that had phenomenal wrestling, but the stuff that came after the matches was just as good as the matches themselves, it feels like. So just to see how that just really just shook the world. And, you know, I think one of the big takeaways for me is that Jericho is showing, like the Bucks, that, you know, you can basically jump in the driver's seat of your own career. It's just how you do it. And, you know, he's earned the right to be able to do what he wants to do, specifically in spite of WWE, who can be, you know, up in arms if they want to. But, you know, up yours, WWE, because we're getting a phenomenal show because it's brilliant to capitalize on all this wave of things between New Japan and WWE, specifically with the Bullet Club against guys like Reigns and such, and capitalize off that momentum and come after Kenny Omega, ironically, for the U.S. title as a Canadian.
Two Canadians in Tokyo fighting for the U.S. Heavyweight Championship, of course.
Oh, alrighty, you gotta love wrestling.
Oh yeah, for sure.
just phenomenal stuff. And again, will not be the last surprise of the night, but again, it shook the wrestling world in the best of ways, and it is another reason why, you know, Wrestle Kingdom appears to have the best card of the year, and this is even just before we even see the show.
So. Yeah, exactly. And then the next match on the card, after that breathless effort, was the IWGP Intercontinental Championship match between Hiroshi Tanahashi and Kota Ibushi. Tanahashi successfully defends in 29 minutes and 26 seconds. And dear God, this was a good wrestling match. Just up and down, exactly what you wanted. Ibushi trying to prove himself against the great Tanahashi. Tanahashi still keeps rolling like there's no tomorrow. Yes, he's slower. Yes, he isn't taking the risks he used to take. But by God, he knows how to put a wrestling match together. And 9.47 from the cage match users, 4.75 stars from Meltzer. This is high praise. Probably isn't the best match of the year. I'm still saying Kenny versus Okada 1 is probably the first, my favorite match of the year so far. But this was absolutely sensational. Marcus, what did you think of this?
Phenomenal. And again, that conversation about the Omega Okada match is probably 2 for me, just because I had to go back and watch that again just to really appreciate what they did with that. But out of 1 and 2, I mean, you can't lose either way. I think the finale was a finishing finale, but it didn't have anything on those first 2 outings.
Yeah.
For me. But to this match, I mean, like you said, phenomenal. Again, a story between these two. It's damn good to see Ibushi back in New Japan, because obviously I think I missed his first run. And he's very much a guy that likes to kind of do what he wants to. Even though he's a young guy in his career, he very much likes to. He's a journeyman, and he's a journeyman by choice. But it's good to see him back and just telling that story again. The history between him and Ibushi. Tanahashi. And just quick shout out to New Japan. That IC belt looks phenomenal. I hated Naito ruining the old one, but it was the best thing ever because the new one just, if that's not a belt you put on a wall or a mantle, I don't know what is. It looks gorgeous, and, you know, just the lineage of that match, and, you know, this match itself was definitely worthy of that, and just telling that story of Ibushi kind of being that young guy against Tanahashi, who's really battle weary, definitely battle tested, without a shadow of a doubt. He's the ace of New Japan, but really a guy who's obviously beaten and taken the L to Ibushi before, but also somebody wanting to elevate Ibushi, if that's even possible.
Yeah,
kind of telling the story of wanting to kind of push him and maybe take his spot one day. But it's kind of that thing of, I taught you everything, you know, not necessarily everything I know. Scenario, which I really thought was great. And you really saw both of them really push each other to the limits, kind of having to go to a lot of moves several times. And Ibushi really, you know, countering Tanahashi in spots we normally just see him nail right out the gate. But, you know, again, it's just a testament to these two, you know, having the history and just being, you know, this main event level talent. Obviously not, like you said, not the best match of the year, but it was damn good. Again, coming from out of WWE, I'm so used to a lot of times the best match not being the main event a lot of times.
Yeah.
So just, again, being refreshed by New Japan, seeing how well these matches are not only, you know, timed but paced as well, really allowing the main event to feel like the main event, and rightfully so. So, again, a phenomenal outing by these two. Ibushi, even as great as he is, still has a long way to go, which is only a bonus for the fans.
Yeah.
So when that day he finally does, you know, knock off a Tanahashi and get an IC championship or something else, it's gonna mean that much more because of battles like this. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, like, I was just thinking, like, we look at this card that we've just gone through and the card we went through previously that had us pulling our hair out. The differences between the two, and what are the differences between a successful and an unsuccessful wrestling company, and these are rules that are the same regardless of where you are in the world, what style you're trying to do. Okay, look at all these matches. Marty Scurll, established character, we know what he's about. Against Will Ospreay, an established character, we know what he's about. Kenny Omega, Beretta, Tanahashi, Ibushi, we know what all of these wrestlers are like. We know the movesets, we know their characters, we know their style, we know about their fighting spirit. They have been explained to us clearly and cleanly over and over and over again. There is nothing there confusing about what we are going to see. We can still be surprised because we're expecting so many things. They've built up an expectation and they've met it. And you AB that against the Impact Wrestling Bound for Glory. We don't know really who OVE are. We're not that sure what LAX are like. We pretty much like, we know what Alberto El Patron's like. We don't like him. We haven't had a chance to appreciate Eli Drake to be a main eventer yet. And we don't really know if Johnny Impact's staying around. So it's harder to get invested in these characters, and therefore it's harder to enjoy the show because you really don't know what's going to happen. There has to be a set of expectations there, and they kind of have to be met. And that's what New Japan has been doing every month, week in, week out, from house shows to major events. Here is something cool, and it's going to be as good as you think it's going to be. And that's something no one else has managed all year long.
Amen. Yeah. Amen. Yeah, like you said, and for so many of these guys to have, you know, several meetings of their belt, New Japan does such a good job, as opposed to a lot of times what we get over here. You know, you see a guys have a bunch of matches, but by the time you get to the end of a feud, it seems like all these matches blend together. But you get, you know, feuds where you can literally discerningly, you know, you know, compartmentalize the different matches. Like, everybody can pick apart, you know, the three matches with Okada and Omega because they're very different in that regard, and rightfully so because of, you know, the intensity into which that feud got to. But, you know, it's always telling a story. It's never ignoring its history. A lot of times, like WWE does, you have somebody like Shawn Michaels and Undertaker had that great WrestleMania match. But before that, you would have never thought, before that initial feud, you would have never thought they even met, which is wrong because they had feud before that. But WWE a lot of times likes to manipulate its own history and sometimes cut out or, you know, kind of oversell things. But with New Japan, it's just simple. You know, these guys have a long tenured history. I mean, just going back to the fact that, you know, Naito's whole thing coming back to Osaka was this kind of where it all started. And this is why, you know, they hate him, and this is why this kind of wound will never heal. But that's just great storytelling because the guy essentially is just a grade A wrestler, but also a grade A butthole. in terms of just, you know, why these guys hate him, and he feeds into that, and that only helps the character. But again, just adding to the chapters of the sagas with these wrestlers, this is just another, you know, page in the chapter of Ibushi Tanahashi, you know, another page in a chapter of Squirrel Osprey. And, you know, these are just endless stories that you never get tired of hearing with New Japan, and nobody does it better.
Well, you look at this. I mean, Suzuki versus Yano has been going for 4 years now. Ibushi versus Tanahashi has been going for 3 years as a story. Omega versus Breta, that one was new. But generally speaking, these stories are taking a long time to play out. We may have got Yano versus Suzuki for the last time. I'm not sure if they can tell any more stories with those two. But they chased each other off over two promotions over the space of 4 years. And yep. With essentially a 15-minute comedy match. And that's all they did for 4 years. And they all made a living and made a ton of money. What more could you want?
Exactly.
But there you go. Right, at the end of that match, Hiroshi Tanahashi went into his usual air guitar celebration after a very sportsmanlike hug of Yung Ibushi. And then it went dark again. Did they pay the light bill at New Japan Pro Wrestling very often? It went dark again. And there was another video that came up. And this video was Switchblade. And it was revealed to be former New Japan young boy Jay White, who came down to ringside, attacked Tanahashi, left him laying, and walked away saying, "It's always going to be about me and you. It always was going to be about me and you." Which is an interesting and new character for Jay White to play. I was a bit iffy, because Jay White has got literally a baby's face. He does look about 12 years old. But I think he's going to grow into this. I have no skills, no worries about his skill set. He's a phenomenal wrestler. But I'm intrigued to see how well this goes. What did you think, Marcus?
Yeah, and I was going to say something about this in a chat, but I said I'd wait to, you know, get to the show to talk about it. But, you know, I've got introduced to Jay White through Ring of Honor, and while he is a great talent, I never really connected to him character-wise, just because it kind of just seems like he was a guy that was there and never... you know, really did anything that really made me attached to him, like somebody like a Squirrel or Lethal or guys like Cody, who for good or bad, they make you tune in and they get you attached to him one way or the other. So White, I think, needed something like this. And you know, again, New Japan paying off all those videos we've been getting over the past few months with the whole, and I love the Switchblade thing, you know, having the necklace. I hope that becomes a thing for him where he leaves like a Switchblade necklace on the guys he's gonna fight.
Yeah.
Kind of taking them out, but now that's a great thing. Like you said, he literally has a baby's face, but I think it's kinda made up for, I guess, with that great hair he has. Kind of draping over the eye, which adds to this type of character, and obviously, you know, him abandoning the white and kinda doing the all black leather. I'm digging the new wares from White, and I think this is something that can really get me, like I said, you know, invested in him as a character, you know, besides his in-ring stuff. So I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to see how he evolves with this. And if you're gonna go out to somebody in New Japan, why not the Ace?
Yeah, exactly.
Why not the Ace? I mean, it's Tanahashi. You know, even again, we talk about this all the time with New Japan, having multiple champions, multiple championships, and making them all seem important. Obviously, Okada is top dog, but you know, the other top dog is Tanahashi, and the other top championship is the IWGP and the Continental title, where elsewhere we see that kind of be a mid-card title. It is absolutely the furthest thing from a mid-card title in New Japan, as it should be because of his lineage and because of how they've treated it. And Jay White is right to go out to Tanahashi specifically, even though he has that torn bicep, still kicking out phenomenal matches. So I'm very much, again, the fire building for Wrestle Kingdom is just it's insane. He adopted that finisher from Shelley, who I think he's that was his mentor, right?
Yeah, in New Japan, and it was. We will close out our New Japan coverage today with looking forward to the World Tag League, which starts this month on November the 18th. So we're going to go through to December the 11th, another tournament, because we do love a tournament in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And the teams for this year's tournament actually look better than any teams ever in any tournament. Bad Luck Fale and Chase Owens, a Bullet Club team I can really get behind. I love Bad Luck Fale and Chase Owens. They're awesome. Evil and Sanada from Los Ignorables de Japón. Hangman Page and Yujihiro Takahashi, the Tokyo Pimps. Hiroki Goto and Yoshihashi from Chaos. Hiroshi Tenzan and Satoshi Kojima. Ken Kozy make another crack at this tournament, which they must have won like seven times or something. Or they may never have won it at all, be one of those things. Juice Robinson and Sami Callihan. Yes, that's Sami Callihan that killed the audience at Bound for Glory. He's going to this as well. Manabu Nakanishi and Yuji Nagata, Lumpy and Kick Heavy, and Minoru Suzuki, Murder Dad, and Takashi Iizuka, Crazy Person, who he's the one that attacks commentators and tapes them to ring posts. So that could be, anything could happen with them. Who's your favourite in this one, Marcus?
Ah, man. Like you said, those are some phenomenal pairings. But I'm gonna stray away from my Bullet Club and my Chaos, I guess, roots, if you will, even though obviously everybody know how much I like Goto and whatnot. I'm gonna go with somebody that's grew on me and somebody that's been a long time fan of, has very much enjoyed his New Japan run and the evolution in New Japan. I'm going with Evil and Sanada.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think that's a good sleeper choice myself. I kind of think I'm looking at Hiroshi Tenzan and Satoshi Kojima because they tend to do better in the tag tournament than they do in the singles tournament because they're historically a great tag team. But I think you're pretty much bang on with Evil and Sanada. I would also suggest Goto and Yoshihashi are looking pretty good as well. Those are my picks, I think. I'm not sure about Tokyo Pimps. I think there's kind of like four or five going to be vying at the top in that group, so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah.
All right, then, Block B. The Best Friends, Beretta and Sexy Chucky T. Chuck Taylor's in Chaos. Oh my God. How did that happen? Anyway.
Well, the application process is getting watery.
What's the HR policy for Chaos these days? Anyway, Davey Boy, they're one team. Killer Elite Squad, Davey Boy Smith and Lance Archer are the current IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team Champions. They're in this tournament. David Finlay and Katsuya Kitamura are also in this tournament. Hansen and Raymond Rowe, the War Machine. Henare and Togi Makabe, which could be quite interesting with a young boy in there. And, you know, he's filling in for his fallen partner of Togi Makabe, Honma, Jeff Cobb and Michael Elgin, which was due to be Jeff Cobb and Matt Riddle. And then Matt Riddle realised, oh, I smoke a lot of bananas and they don't like that in Japan, so he's not off. Tama Tonga and Tangaloa, the Gorillas of Destiny, they're also in there. And, of course, former IWGP Tag Team Champions Tomohiro Ishii and Toriano are also in this group. Who's your favourites in this one, Marcus?
Another interesting pairing of teams. If I had to pick two, I'm going, let's see. I'm going with a favorite of mine just because I love these guys. And even though it might go against, natural New Japan wisdom, I'm going with my Gorillas. And after that, I'll take Jeff Cobb and Michael Elgin because, good God, that is a lot of man coming for a lot of guys. That is a lot of men, a lot of man mass coming for a lot of teams. And me knowing Jeff Cobb from obviously being more familiar with Cobb's work in Lucha, as the one Matanza Cueto. Shout out to Lucha for getting the fourth season.
But,
that is a lethal pairing if I ever see one.
I can't wait to see them against Killer Elite Squad. That's going to be awesome. Everybody dies. It's just going to be brilliant.
Everybody.
Speaking of which, Killer Elite Squad against Beretta and Chuck Taylor. That's going to be fantastic. Because, like, Lance Archer and Davey Boy Smith Jr. are the two of the most straight-laced, straight-up-and-down wrestlers you can possibly imagine. And Chuck Taylor just so isn't.
Different. Does he wear shoes in his matches?
Not always, no.
Use him a Riddle because Riddle's like kind of more MMA style or something.
I think he's a distant relation of Mr. Azerbaijan from Shikara. They look very similar in body type. I couldn't possibly say they were the same person, but they look very similar. And I've never, maybe. Something like that. But anyway, yes. this is the Chuck Taylor, by the way, not the Chuck Taylor who lost. Yeah, this is the Chuck Taylor who lost his name, Chuck Taylor, to the other Chuck Taylor who's in Chikara at the moment. That's why he's called Chucky T in this tournament. Anyway, so we'll see what happens there. It's just going to be ace. But that's the World Tag League, which will start on November the 18th on New Japan World. And that kind of wraps up our coverage for Bound for Glory and for Power Struggle for today. This has been the True Penny Show. But before we go, we had some sad news last week as the WrestleTalk TV, the Daily Squash, as it used to be called, and the Squash, as it's been called recently, came to an end. And I'd like to personally thank Gavin Duenas, Ben Spindler, Paul Taylor, and everybody else who has hosted the show, including our founder, of course, Alex Shane, for giving me the opportunity to have my own podcast, for giving me the opportunity to host the Squash for a little while, and for giving us all an opportunity to be wrestling writers on a big stage. And I think you'd probably like to say the same, wouldn't you, Marcus?
Yeah, I mean, I just echo your sentiments. I mean, you know, always, you know, grateful, you know, to you and specifically, you know, Ben, who I kind of came into this whole thing with, you know, allowed me to get on the platform of WrestleTalk to, you know, kind of say my points and whatnot and do some great writing there, and obviously introduced me to the podcast network, and then which led me to doing these shows with you. So I'm forever grateful for all you guys, you know, just for allowing me to come in here and give my opinions and whatnot. So, you know, shout out to those boys for doing such great work for a long time, and you know, and they're going to be great whatever they do next, so, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You can find Paul Taylor on his Travel Monkey YouTube channel. Go watch that, because it's fun stuff. It's been cool. I've been watching some of their stuff. And I'm sure we'll catch up with Ben and Gavin on the True Penny Show at some point in the future. So, in the meantime, I'd like to say thank you for my guest today, Mr. Marcus Green. That's at Paradox Kid on Twitter.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
We'll be back next week. We might be back on the History Pro Wrestling, but coming up soon, it's our year-end awards and our year-end show where we normally break down what's gone on in Japan and Europe and Asia. So we're probably going to have an awful lot to talk about. And if you've got something specific you want to talk to us about it on Twitter. You can usually catch us there. Take care, and we'll speak to you next week. Bye!